Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is anniversary episode number 300 of the podcast. A very exciting day. It is the 17th of December, 2016, as I record this, and I have a mega show today with Mark Lefebvre from Kobo. Mark gets very overexcited. He's a lovely Canadian chap, and I'm excited, but Mark is even more excited for episode 300. So we look back at what's changed for indies since episode 200 in November 2014, plus my mistakes and lessons learned along the way. And you'll also hear a bit about what we think might happen between now and episode 400, which should be around November 2018, if I carry on at this rate, which it's quite, you know, it feels like it's a long time away, but also not a long time away. Time will fly by. Okay, so and I'll do my usual intro, but we want to get on with the show. It's quite a long one today. But in publishing news, I actually finally got that KDP new backend look at kdp.amazon.com. It, you know, where it offers the paperback option. I'm not necessarily going to use that, although it's interesting because maybe at some point they will get rid of CreateSpace. I mean, it's an interesting thought. But those of you who, I think the Americans must have got it first and now it seems to be over here. So they're obviously rolling out around the world, which means that everyone will get it eventually. But essentially, there's a different look and feel on the KDP backend. But the biggest change is this paperback thing. So if I do use it, I'll let you know, but probably I won't because I am now working with Ingram for extended distribution and I will be still using CreateSpace for print. A couple of other things in publishing this week. Tim Grohl, who also does the StoryGrid podcast, launched a new podcast on book launching called The Book Launch Show. So check that out. Tim's been on the podcast, on this podcast before, and he's super useful. So definitely check that out. His approach to book launches is very structured and interesting. So check that out, The Book Launch Show. Also this morning in The Guardian, which, you know, there's been all this stuff about, you know, you should really read outside of your liberal sort of niche so that you appreciate other points of view. I did try that. And then I just retreated back to The Guardian, which is certainly a liberal niche in the UK. But there was an article this morning, Redundancy Fears as Penguin Random House Derecognizes Staff Unions. I don't know if derecognizes is actually a word. It might be, maybe it's a legal word. But essentially Penguin Random House saying, we're not going to bother with these trade union things. We'll just do our own thing. You know, and a lot of traditional publishing authors who I know are sort of going, oh, this is worrying. This is not very book-like. This is not very appropriate for the publishing industry, which should be lovely to people and authors and their lovely employees. And it made me, I mean, obviously it's not great, but it seems to be part of the myth of publishing, that publishing companies are some, should be held up to some higher standard to other companies, which I think is classic because HarperCollins, obviously not Penguin Random House, but one of the other massive publishing companies, is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, which also does Fox News, the News of the World, The Sun, and a whole load of other things which are not necessarily considered high culture. So I would just say that this is big business, classic big business move, and that the, you know, increasingly this is why, one of the reasons people are choosing to be independent, because you can be sure if you're doing this in an independent manner that you can do things in the most ethical way that you want to do. So I saw that and my first thought was, oh look, you know, they are feeling the crunch and they're going to do things so they don't have to pay out so much money to their employees. And
frankly, you know, they have the right to do that as a company. Now, I have my own company. I don't have lots and lots of employees, but, you know, the way I run my company is I choose my ethics and I choose my independence. So I think this is just another interesting side of the way publishing is right now, which is we have these absolutely enormous conglomerates who are big publishing. And then I think we have the rise of this indie movement, which is not just, you know, you on your own self-publishing, but also, you know, I'm starting to publish more. You know, there are lots of independent publishing imprints who are working in an ethical manner. So we have to choose the industry we're part of. So I hope you guys will think about that as you move upwards and onwards in your publishing career. In futurist stuff, probably the most interesting thing that just happened, again, this was this morning as I was just reading, I read a couple of blogs in the mornings, and I was reading digitaltrends.com, which is I really enjoy, and WordPress has launched a virtual reality plugin. So basically, WordPress has now made it possible to publish and view virtual reality content through its platform. So many of your favorite blogs and publications can now display VR and 360 degree content in an easy to view fashion. So basically, if you're viewing the website through, you know, your normal computer, then you will see it as flat and 2D. Or if you are wearing a VR device, you will be able to see it in virtual reality, and there will be other content and 360 degree content, stuff like that, which is awesome. The reason this is interesting to me, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a futurist person, but I actually do think that we will be surfing the web in VR, like Christmas shopping. Why do I have to shop for Christmas stuff on a flat screen? Yeah, sure, I could walk around the shops, but I hate shopping. I'm just not a shopping person. So why can't I, you know, shop in VR and pick up things and have that tactile experience of shopping without having to leave my house? Now, you might think that's sad, but I also think that a lot of you understand what I'm talking about. And I mean, Bath recently, we've had the Christmas market, which many people love. And for those of us who live here, it's just like hell. You know, all these people just cramming into town and we're like, what are you doing? But anyway, I think it's really interesting that WordPress has introduced this plugin. And not that I'll be doing anything with it now, but what it means is it's starting to set the infrastructure for when more and more people will use VR. But what is probably more for this Christmas, certainly we have one, is the Amazon Echo. Now we have the Echo Dot, which are these little, I guess they're sort of almost mug size, sort of the bottom of the mug. They're thinner than a mug, but you know, that sort of size, not very big. And you can talk to Alexa, and my husband's put the lights through it, so you can say, Alexa, turn on the blue lamp. And you know, and you might think, again, that's sad, but actually it's really cool. And there are these things called Alexa skills, and the skills are things that Alexa can do. So again, my husband delights in saying things from you know, sort of techie, geeky things like Red Dwarf and Tolkien. And, you know, there are all these things where you can say, like, Alexa, are you Skynet? Or, and, you know, she talks about it. But the reason I wanted to bring it up again is that the first publisher, and coming back to the lovely HarperCollins, HarperCollins Christian Publishing, have launched a skill, a bite-sized daily devotionals for those people who want them through Alexa. So you can add the devotional skill to your Alexa, and you can get a daily, presumably Christian quote or Bible verse or something. Now, I think that's really interesting. And in fact, one of the things I said to Jonathan, my husband, was, I want an Alexa skill. I want to, like, as if, let's say, like mirror, mirror on the wall, you know, here's the fairest of us all. I want to be able to say, Alexa, who is the world's best supernatural thriller author? And Alexa would say, J.F. Penn. So I know that's kind of silly and egotistical. And of course, I haven't written it. But what I was thinking is that there are a lot of things that can be done through Alexa. I mean, one of the things it does is play your audiobooks. So you can, you know, you can be listening on your headset or you can be reading on your Kindle. And then with, you know, you can go over and listen to through Alexa, which is really cool, like when you're cooking or something. So I think that although I'm, you know, love the whole VR thing, I actually think that this type of AI, voice activated AI, is going to be massive in the next year. And I'm really interested as to how we as authors can bring our work into that ecosystem. And I do think that audiobooks, again, will get even bigger because of things like Alexa. Google Home is also coming, and these sort of little AIs that bring stuff that you used to check your phone for. So, you know, like when we were watching The Crown recently on Netflix, which is a great series if you like the royals, you know, I was just checking stuff on my phone. I was like, oh, I want to know, you know, what did happen to that person? And that was really interesting. And those are the types of things you will be able to ask Google Home, particularly, more than Alexa. So anyway, just thought I would mention those things. Personal update this week. Oh, I wanted to report back on the BookBub for my London crime thriller box set, which went out last Sunday. Actually went much better than expected. And this time I did do an ad stacking approach, but I didn't use all the various different websites. I just set up Facebook ads in the US and the UK, and I got the book. It's about the box set of Desecration, Delirium and Deviance in the London Psychic series. And basically, I got it to around 2,000 in both stores with Facebook ads on the Friday and Saturday. And then on the Sunday, when the BookBub hit, it went up to number 31 overall on the US Amazon store, number one in a whole load of subcategories, as well as 25 overall on Amazon.co.uk, plus the top-selling book on the whole Kobo store in Canada. Plus, it also sold over 500 copies each on Nook and iBooks. So around 8,000 copies in the week, which is actually more than the Arcane box set that hit the USA Today list back in August. The difference being that at this time of year, I don't think there's any way I would hit the USA Today list at this time of year, because it is absolutely saturated by traditional publishing Christmas releases. So, and because the promos right now are huge, so the chance of hitting the list at this time of year is absolutely minuscule. And it wasn't even a goal of mine. I actually, one of the specific goals for that was to see if it gave the audio box set a boost. So I've mentioned before that I've set up an audiobook box set of the three books. So Desecration, Delirium, Deviance are out as separate audiobooks on Audible, but they are quite short. They're around 7 hours each. By putting them together as a box set, it's 21 hours worth of listening, which is much better value for an Audible subscriber who has a credit. So these credits are worth, my credits are worth £7.99 in the UK, £7.99. So I want a book that is worth more than £7.99. There's a real psychological shift with that. And so what is interesting is that since 8th of November, so in the just over a month since we released that audiobook box set, we've sold 41 box sets and 15 of them over the BookBub. So still 25, 26 that were not related to the BookBub, compared to the individual books, which have sold 10 in total. Now, I haven't done, apart from, you know, telling you guys on the show, and I don't get that many crossovers from this show to my fiction. But basically the you know, this was significant. I didn't do any other marketing. And I think if this sales level is sustained, it is proof that having a longer product makes a big difference on Audible. So my narrator is thrilled and I'm thrilled, and we're going to do more audiobook box sets in the hope of, you know, because right now traditional publishers haven't really got on that train. So yeah, I think box sets are super important for author income. They really are. Oh, there was also something else on the future thing. Amazon has begun UK drone deliveries, which again is super exciting. It's launched Prime Air service in Cambridge to deliver packages to customers in 30 minutes or less. I so want to have books delivered by drone. I think that would be awesome. So very exciting. Although I think books, it says carrying packages up to £5. So I think books actually might be not happening. I don't know about you, but when books arrive at my house at the moment, they're quite heavy because I'm doing this research for the map, whatever the map series will be. But essentially, I've got all these hardback books with pictures of maps in and they're super heavy. But anyway, I'm pretty excited about the drone stuff. Also, just on audio, back on audiobooks, I've been having this persistent cough. So I'm not going to record myself, my own books until the new year, or maybe even once it gets warm again. Once I've got over that. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets. Here is a little selection. Kristen said, love the podcast with Melissa Addy. So many ideas. Great to fill the creative well. I listened on my morning walk in Hamilton, Ontario on our first snowy morning, which is lovely. Nathan Van Koops, listening while I send out the Christmas cards and feeling jolly. And of course, this is our last show before Christmas. So happy Christmas, everyone. Pete says, on the merchandising, I hope you sell creative pens alongside your super journals. And when Pete said that, I actually told Jonathan, my husband, and said, do you know what? I think we're going to have to do a creative pen range, which is super funny. I love that. But I don't want any of those kind of naff things. You know, it would have to be a nice pen. So I'm not sure that'll happen. Celie James caught up on the show on my drive to the Grand Canyon, sent a picture of the view over the Grand Canyon, which is gorgeous. And the Grand Canyon is definitely somewhere that I really loved and will want to go back to. Chris says, your show has given me the space to dream and I finally finished my first book and plan to launch it tomorrow. You've given me the confidence to hit the publish button. That's fantastic, Chris, because hitting publish is something that a lot of people struggle with. And yet, once you do it, it can be the most liberating thing in the world. And in fact, today I got on Facebook. One of the good things Facebook does is, you know, brings back memories. 8 years ago today, I published a picture of me with my first book, How to Enjoy Your Job or Find a New One. And it's so fascinating that that was 8 years ago. So time flies, really, but things have changed a lot. And all came from that first publishing experience. Ethan says, I spent a few years as a professional songwriter. I want to share how much it fills my heart with goodness to know a viable business model exists for creatives in your content creation vertical, which is awesome. Yes, this is a viable business model, and I think I'm proof of that. Harry says, my dad, who started writing at age 90 and has now written 3 books, I'm helping him edit, format and publish. He lives in South Africa, I live in Denmark, and we are publishing globally. What a wonderful time to be alive with a bunch of stories to tell. And that story is just lovely. Really, oh, it makes me go, oh, that's awesome, Harry and Harry's dad. Also starting to write at age 90, because so many people are like, oh, I wish I would write, but you know, it's too late now. And it's so not too late. I mean, even if there's one thing that you can do before you pop off, and Harry's dad started writing at age 90, has now written 3 books, which is fantastic. So as ever, I love to hear from you guys. Please email me or tweet me at The Creative Pen. I always love to know what you're doing while listening to the show. And next week, I should have some interest. Well, in the next couple of weeks, I guess, we'll hear what you've been doing over the holiday period. I hope you will carve out some time for your writing during this time of year. I'm not a fan of Christmas as much as I am a fan of New Year. I love New Year. I really look forward to New Year because, you know, I'm one of those sort of future people and I'm like, okay, I'm done with 2016 now. What can I do in 2017? So I'm formulating my plans, my evil plans, and not very evil. And I will be sharing those in the next couple of weeks. But we must get on with episode 300. So today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and a huge thanks to Kobo for supporting the show and also indie authors everywhere. While we all love Amazon and, you know, they did change the publishing world for all of us, it's incredibly important for a thriving creative community to have more income streams than just one dominant player. And it's also important for readers all over the world to have more than one option for their reading. So that is why I continue to support Kobo and publish there myself. Mark is co-hosting today's anniversary show, Mark Lefebvre. So you'll hear more about Kobo as we talk, but definitely check out kobo.com/writing life for publishing options. You can also find their podcast and blog at kobowritinglife.com. And there are tips there on how to sell more books on Kobo, which everyone loves. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, including new patrons, Pete and Harry Teacher. And Harry is the one who's Harry's dad. So that's awesome. And I really do appreciate your Patreon support. Demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And everyone supporting on Patreon would have got my extra, slightly longer Q&A show, which I put out in the last week. And if you would like that extra Q&A show, you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right. Happy Christmas, everyone. And here's the interview with Mark. And I'll be back for episode 301 on Boxing Day. Bye.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Nathan Maharaj, Director of Merchandising for Kobo. As Kobo's head bookseller, I'm thrilled to be working alongside the Kobo Writing Life team as they usher in the new era of digital publishing. One of the most exciting trends I'm seeing today is self-published authors and hybrid authors who are climbing out of the 99-cent price band to offer their work for prices comparable to titles from major publishers. These authors have clearly made investments to make their ebooks the best they can be, from cover design and copy editing to thousands of hours of scribbling away honing their craft. And they're not afraid to ask a competitive but fair price for their work. However you publish, it's a great time to be a writer and an even better time to be a reader. I hope to see you on Kobo soon.
Today, I'm back with Mark Lefebvre, or Mark from Kobo, as he's known. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Joanna. How's it going? Happy 300th anniversary.
Oh, look, you just stole my thunder.
I'm just so excited to be here. I've been a fan of yours for so long. To be in the 300th episode. Oh my God, I'm feeling like I'm tingling. I've got goosebumps. I'm so excited.
Oh no, I'm excited too. So yes, stealing our thunder, today we have a special episode 300, and Mark and I will be interviewing each other, or basically having a chat and talking about the last, well, we probably won't get into the last 6 years of podcasting, but we're certainly going to talk about what's changed in the last 2 years since episode 200. So just a little introduction in case people don't know Mark. Mark is the Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations at Kobo. And he also writes horror and dark humor under Mark Leslie. So Mark is both an author and part of one of our great retailers and also a podcast sponsor. Many hats, Mark.
And one giant head to put all the hats on, of course.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's get started. So the very first show of The Creative Pen went out in March 2009, which is crazy. Episode 200 went out November 2014. So we're going to talk about, like, what are the big things that have changed for indies, for ebooks since 2014? And I wanted to start with, when I went back to try and look at things, was that KU, Kindle Unlimited, launched in July 2014, so a little earlier than episode 200. But that shift, I mean, at the time, I think you will remember too, the sort of subscription model for readers hadn't taken off. There was Oyster, there was Scrib, but it hadn't really taken off. So what do you think the biggest sort of impact of KU's been for readers and authors?
Well, I mean, I think, and you have to credit Amazon for this in many, many ways, because it was the launch of the Kindle that really made ebook publishing a big thing, particularly for indie authors. So we have to go back and respect that. I think it was KU was one of the subscription models that was brought to a larger group. You did have Scribd, You had Oyster. You had. I remember sitting in digital conferences, looking at the subscription model, and everyone noodling over and saying, "I don't know if they're ever going to make this work. It's not like a gym membership where you buy it and you never use it. It's kind of like it's not like the Netflix model." So when Amazon did it, they did it to the largest audience of readers possible who already had those Kindle devices there. So that really made the subscription model people stand up and take notice to the subscription model. And I still think we're in the early phases of that readership. I want to go back to Netflix because that's something that a lot of people are probably familiar with. I mean, Netflix started as wasn't it like a distribution where you'd get a disc in the mail and then they started streaming later on? So I still think we're in the very early phases of the subscription model and of different models for reading. E-reading, you have to remember, as much as you and I live and breathe this world every single day, I'm reminded constantly that, you know, for most territories globally in English language markets, 80% of the market is still print distribution. And we forget that because there's so much going on in digital. And so when you think about a subscription model that is not, you know, the consumer buys it and owns the digital copy, but they actually have access to it. Libraries are stronger than ever before in e-reading, and obviously we've got some great things going on at Kobo, and I'm just saying that because I'm a biased party that really loves what we're doing with Overdrive. But the subscription model is yet another way to make reading easier and to bring it to more people. So that audience is only going to grow and help, and particularly indie authors who are digital and digital first, or digital natives when you think about to bring up an old term. It gives them access to more customers. So those kinds of models bring more people into reading digitally, and more people reading digitally is what we all need, right? Retailers, authors, et cetera.
Mm. Yeah, so it's interesting because I'm an Amazon Prime customer, and I didn't go into KU for ages. But this year I thought, I'm going to have to join the program to try it out, just, the experience. And it's really interesting because I do find myself clicking specifically on books that are KU in order to, and then it says, you already have 10 checked out. Which one do you want to check back in again? And that's really interesting. And I think it's so important for us to understand how people are buying these things. But probably the biggest impact for authors is the change in payments. So it used to be that you got payout based on borrows, and then we've moved to this pages read model. But what's interesting, even as we talk, in the last 2 weeks, Amazon advertising has now opened up to non-KDP Select. And we should mention that Select is different to KU in terms of, Select is, you have to be just on Amazon, whereas KU is the reader side. But KU has obviously impacted what you get on KDP Select. So I'm really fascinated because I saw a big, obviously I'm wide, that's why you're here. But I saw a big benefit, like one of the biggest benefits I thought for people in KDP Select was Amazon advertising. And they've now opened up. So to me, this is actually a big shift. I in fact, in the last 2 days, I've set up my ads for my books that are wide on Amazon. And this seems like a really interesting model. And we'll talk later about how things are going to go forward. But paid advertising is another big thing. So what are your thoughts on how the whole paid advertising space has shifted?
So I have a pretty unique perspective on Amazon going wide with their ads. It's exactly what BookBub has seen. I mean, BookBub came in, indie authors were there first, they were buying ads, they were killing it, they were making, billions of dollars. It was rocking the world. And then along trundles traditional publishing with big bucks to spend, but they used to buy giant, full page ads and newspapers. And now they're turning those marketing dollars into BookBub. And so now it's harder for indie authors to get those spaces. Well, Amazon's a pretty smart company. They kind of know what they're doing. So they're opening this up because if they want money from big publishers, they know big publishers, real publishers, don't just go throw in exclusively with a single retailer. They want that money. They're smart. They're good business people. They're going to open it up so more people can buy. The other thing about targeted ads, and this kind of leads to the more things we're doing at Kobo I can talk about later, is when you don't mass broadcast, when you more specifically target and narrow in on the niches, you may not get as many eyeballs on the book, but you get the right eyeballs on the book. And that targeted ad means more people can buy more ads for more money, and Amazon can actually start to make a profit, which could be a good thing for everyone, right? Because, you know, you actually still make good money off of what they do. See, I can work for a competitor to Amazon and still recognize and acknowledge the great things that they're doing for authors, because I'm an author on that platform too, and I haven't yet taken advantage of the ads, and I'm looking forward to now being able to try it out, because, you know, everything's worth a shot.
And I think that's really important. I mean, because what we've seen probably in the last 2 years, we've seen, I'm pretty sure BookBub was around more than 2 years ago, but we saw the indies, as you said, the indies moved in, Facebook advertising, of course, Mark Dawson's stuff, and, you know, indies really, I think 2015 was when Mark launched that course for the first time. So, and obviously there were authors before that in 2014 who were using Facebook advertising, I think mainly in the romance space. And then suddenly, or not suddenly, over the last 2 years, paid advertising through Facebook, Amazon, BookBub, Free Booksy, Bargain Booksy, these types of sites have kind of matured. And the other, and we've seen more and more tools. And we've also seen, I guess, Facebook themselves change to a pay-to-play model, just on a bigger sense, from a, you know, organic reach to pay-to-play.
Yeah.
Do you think that we have moved into a more of a pay-to-play merchandising atmosphere? Like, are there still things that authors can do without paying to play?
So it's kind of interesting, because the pay-to-play model, let's take Facebook as a perfect example. You used to have an author page that you would post it there and all your followers would see it. But then there was more and more and more. There was more connections, more things to see. And Facebook wants to keep you engaged in the platform. And they recognize that advertisers want people to engage with their thing. So it's kind of like, again, a business move for them to make money off of that. I mean, I've specifically targeted ads myself as an author, you know, following the teachings of the Mark Dawsons of the world who share their expertise and knowledge. And he's really helped me, you know, fine tune those things. But then, you know, from a Kobo Writing Life perspective, we've targeted, we've taken ads out about the books that Kobo authors are paying to be placed in features. And we're pushing those ads out to, not to writers, but to readers who we know are reading on Kobo, and we're trying to draw them in that way, because we're trying to do everything we can to make sure that authors who are investing in their sales on Kobo are actually seeing those return on the profits. So it kind of speaks to the curation model, right? I've been a bookseller for 25 years, so it's always been about curation, and we have more things than ever before. How do we balance and juggle that and put those books in front of the right people? And that's kind of, paid advertising is one answer to that solution, because it separates the wheat from the chaff. It separates those who are the scammers and the ones who are in to try and make a quick Kindle buck or a quick Kindle million, to those who are in this for the long term and who are dedicated to working at finding their target audience or who know their target audience and are using these as tools to get to those people.
Although it's funny, because I know there are then people listening going, but I'm a good writer and I've got a good book. Like, I've got a literary fiction novel that is really good and I don't have the money to spend on advertising. Does that mean that only the people who have money, like people have always bought their way into the New York Times list, right? So does that mean that those books won't get out there? And actually, it's so funny, because my answer is becoming, look, maybe you need a small press, maybe you need a traditional publisher, because either, you know, that you want the publisher to be paying for the advertising, or you have to do it yourself. So I'm almost now kind of saying that, you know, you have to decide how much you want your book out there. Is it go traditional and expect someone else to pay the money, or are you going to pay the money?
Sure. I have to say this because we're an international podcast, right? Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same. and that is that. And it's so true, because for some books, that's exactly that. I do that with Dundurn. I'm the self-pub guy at Kobo. I'm the one trying to convince people to take a DIY ethic and to do it yourself and look at what you can do. And yet I gladly and willfully sign rights to a traditional publisher because I know that the niche markets that they cater to, the distribution I get into bookstores, into Walmart, into Costco, the last book, Creepy Capital, was everywhere. I think it was at grocery stores as well, which mm. I could never have done myself. Maybe I could have done myself, but nowhere near as good. So those literary titles are perhaps better served by those niche markets. The other thing too is there's always exceptions to every process, to every rule. You know, you think about there's so many great books being written and published today that sometimes it is just luck after lots and lots of perseverance. And then you just hit it, right? There's just that one thing that happens and says, I'm going to make this into a movie. And then all of a sudden, that's the luck that happens. But that luck would not have happened without all the hard work. I mean, it kind of goes back to, you know, the same principles that that we've talked about. Now, I have to, not to change topics, but I want to find out what has changed for you since the end.
Oh, no. Before we move on to me.
I can't go there yet.
No, you can't, because this is highly structured. I want you to just, you've mentioned a couple of things about Kobo. Some things have changed for Kobo since 2014. One of the biggest things, I think, is the Kobo promotional tab, which is available to specific authors, has really helped people with a bigger backlist and quality titles to get out there. But what are the other things that have changed for Kobo since the end of 2014?
So I think the promo tab is great, and we're doing some things internally to try and figure out. Right now, it's just specifically for merchandising spaces on the website. We're looking at, are there other things we can do with testing for targeted emails? And then here's one of the things that I think leads, and it's kind of promo tool and it's kind of curation, but it's also related to stuff our merchandising team has been doing with big data. And so Nathan Maharaj, the director of merchandising, the global merchandising team, and the big data team are actually taking the best of human curation and the best of machine curation and merging them. So more and more of our emails that we're sending out aren't just, you submit, let's say we get 500 or 600 submissions to be featured in a 200 title sale. And then what would happen is a bunch of humans who put the email together go, well, these six covers look nice. We'll put these in the email. And everyone gets those six covers. And it's great. Hey, Jo Penn got, one of her Arcane books got featured in it because somebody in Toronto thought this was a good cover, which is great. But what about all the readers who aren't into thrillers? What about the ones that are there for romance? So taking the list of those 200 titles and using big data to develop a really complex affinity score means that I may get the JF Penn title in the feed because I've read several of her books and I've rated them really high and I love them and I can't wait to get to the next one. So I might see that title, but the reader beside me who's a romance fan or a literary fan might get that title that has a higher affinity score for them, meaning less people see the title, but more people who are the right people see the title. Mm. And the increase in sales that we've seen from that testing demonstrates that. What I love about this is we can now include more titles because we can then line up those titles with specific customers rather than saying, okay, we have a James Patterson style. Everyone wants James Patterson. We have a Dan Brown. Everyone wants Dan Brown. As opposed to doing that, we can more specifically cater to those markets. So that literary title you spoke about, that good literary title, could potentially get to exactly the right people. So I'm really excited about how we can incorporate those two things. The other thing I'm really excited about is what we're doing with our sister company, Overdrive. Mm. So Rakuten owns Overdrive. Early beta testing has been absolutely phenomenal, considering that we have just over 200 titles in the beta program. I was just running a sales report for an author this morning because it's all manual right now. So that's why it's very, very limited, and saying, okay, here's what you've sold in the last month. And I'm really excited about that because it leads to that next step. I'm now seeing authors who are selling through Kobo into the US, which was never a big market for authors in the US. Now they're selling to a different market in the US. And so our strategies for 2017 have a lot more to do with how do we help the libraries find the right titles. So for example, let's use J.F. Penn as an example. People who love Dan Brown love these kinds of thrillers. Here's another author that you may not be familiar with that you should be checking out as a librarian that you should be stalking. I mean, the easiest one that we've done to date is Diane Capri. Mm. You know, You Like Lee Child, The Hunt for Jack Reacher. Well, there's a direct tie-in right there. Mm. And so the libraries have just gone nuts to buy those. And so Shayna on my team, who's doing a lot of that amazing work, is she's doing the manual curation to say, well, people who like these kinds of authors, here's a bunch of KWL authors who have similar titles that we're pretty sure your patrons, your customers will like, and putting together packages to the libraries to say, hey, here's what you like, here's what you know your patrons want, and you've got a waiting list for 500 people who are waiting for that book. Why don't they check out that J.F. Penn title while they're waiting? Mm-hmm. It may as well give them something that they want, and then suddenly you have another fan. Those are the kinds of things I'm really excited about.
That's cool. And just a comment on that, you know, what we've seen with Nook in the last 2 years is Nook shut down all of their global sites to focus on America. And what I think is really important for everyone to know is that Kobo is still expanding, and that I think that's a really important point, because any company that is shrinking their digital side, that's just not a good sign. So it'd be really interesting. We're going to come back to the future, but I'm really, you know, pleased that you guys are still expanding. And we, you know, who knows what Apple are doing, because they never tell us anything, but but I'm kind of more,
well,
more
I know Apple's with it, sir.
Yeah, iBooks. Yeah. Okay. Right. You can ask me now.
Okay. Well, let's get to that. So I imagine a lot has changed for you since 2014. It's been 2 years. What has changed?
Yeah. So first of all, on about that growing stuff. So I went back and had a look. So in November 2014, I had 8 fiction books and 4 nonfiction. So that's 12. And I had sold through Kobo in 58 countries. I'm just about to put out book 21. It's on pre-order, and I've sold in 86 countries. So I guess the very first thing is I've written more books, and that should always, I think, yeah, that should always be everybody's baseline. Like, look back 2 years, have you at least finished a book, or have you moved your creative self forward? And I think by writing those books, I've become a better writer. So I think that's really important. The next thing, I guess, in terms of big things, my husband left his job.
Yep.
And we hit our first multi six-figure year. So this is another thing, you know, I started writing in 2006. And I left my job in 2011. So I'm at the kind of 10-year overall stage. I'm at the 5-year full-time stage. And this year was kind of the tipping point of making more money than I made in my day job. And I think that's something else to mention, that it's to do with time in the market and consistent creation. And that's not just from book sales. That's also, you know, podcast sponsorship, going to Patreon with the show. That's my website traffic, my affiliate income. It's like everything has gone up. And if you think of it like the snowball, you know, it really does start very, very small. Like I showed someone the other day, my first affiliate payment ever was like $1.53.
And that's a lot, actually.
Yeah, exactly. That's loads of money. And I was just like, you can't imagine when you make your first $1.53 that it will ever, like, you will ever be able, like, my husband was able to leave his job because of all these things kind of coming together. So that was a really big thing. Yeah, going weekly with the podcast, like, that's actually been quite significant, because 2 years ago, it was interesting. I actually, coming up to episode 200, I thought I was going to shut down the Creative Pen, not the whole website, but I was going to stop the podcast and I was going to focus on fiction. But instead of actually, like, doubled down on the Creative Pen and helping people and empowering authors, and I've gone back into courses because again, the market has matured to a point where people want more training and there's more authors joining. So those are probably some of the biggest things. Also narrating my own audiobooks. ACX came to the UK. I'm actually next week about to start narrating my next audiobook, nonfiction, for myself. So yeah, those are probably some of the biggest things.
It's interesting that you spoke about all the elements and all the pieces that make up the Joanna Penn, JF Penn, Creative Penn business enterprise with your husband and all those pieces. And you've always been an advocate for having multiple streams of income, having those multiple sources. And you're the poster child for that, not just in, you know, selling to Kindle and Kobo and Nook and iBooks and as many places as you can make your books available, but in the types of content you produce, which I just admire. And I've taken that, thank you, by the way, after we were in London earlier this year and you were talking about the journals and the other print books that you put out. I've traditionally published some books, but I did a ghostwriter's journal so that people can record their own ghost hunts. And again, it's $5. It's cheap. It's just sort of an add-on extra thing. But thanks to you, you've helped me become a much better writer and a much better business person. And I have to say this because I know there are people listening to this 300th episode who want to say, oh my God, Joe, thank you so much for not giving in after episode 200. Thank you for doing this because you have given our community so much. You've given me, you've given so many other writers out there so much information and value, and that I couldn't imagine doing this without having you in my ear every week and being a champion. And no, it's, and I know I'm speaking for thousands of people out there who feel the exact same way. So I'm saying this for them. Thank you for the last 2 years and for obviously the stuff before.
Oh, thank you so much. And I guess the other thing has really been for me sort of that realization, and it always, I think the Patreon thing has been a really big deal in terms of, like, when I started that, I literally did not think anybody would sponsor the show. And, you know, Kobo obviously sponsored the show, but I gave up the other sponsor because now the Patreon support is big enough to do that. And I guess it's it makes it worthwhile. Of course, it takes time, but I love sharing the journey. And I guess I wanted to reiterate that this is a journey. And, you know, when we... maybe we'll do this together in two more years' time. But in the last couple of weeks, I've shared some of the stuff that's going to be changing. Like, I've spent today kind of wrestling with more print ideas and ISBNs, which is something I never thought I would talk about. And like some of the things I'm going to be doing with small press, with foreign rights, and like trying to move to the next level. And you know, anyone who has been on the journey, you know, we're all at different points. I think that's really important for people to realize. So if you go back to 2009 and listen to those early shows, I didn't even do anything personal because I didn't even think people would be interested. And I kind of wish I had done now because I can't figure out what I was thinking back in 2009. All I know is things are so different for me and for indie authors in general. In fact, that was something I was going to say off the back of what you were saying about traditional and hybrid. 2 years ago, there was still energy around them versus us, you know, us versus them, you know, you're self-published, you're traditionally published. And I do think that that's changed quite a lot. I feel it's changed. Like, I feel there's much more openness to me when I go and speak at various publishing events. Do you think that's changed in the last couple of years?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've seen the dramatic changes going back to 2004 when I would not dare admit I had self-published a book to now where I proudly, sometimes in some circles, I sheepishly say, yeah, actually, this was traditionally published. but it's kind of funny because at the end of the day, and there's more and more recognition that the consumer doesn't really care, All the consumer cares about is having access to really good stuff that they want to read and more of it. So yeah, that definitely has continues to change, and there's still a long way to go. I mean, a lot of the challenges, I'll be honest with you, a lot of the challenges that I have that are related to self-publishing is still a misperception of self-publishing, even internally at Kobo, even from people who know, you know, self-published titles at Kobo. One in every four books that sells at Kobo is a self-published title. Most of which, you know, 22-23% of those are from Kobo Writing Life, and then there's the other sources. Yet, if one in every four books is, that sells is self-published, why is there still the stigma that, well, this is probably a book that couldn't get sold, that this is probably a book that's really, really cheap, it's probably a book that hasn't been edited? And that's only because there are still those who haven't yet grasped the business aspect. And that's why, you know, you've always taken that approach, and it's been a long-term thing for you, and you've built and grown. I do want to come back to a little bit of the personal. I love that you share personal. I love that you do the tweet shout-outs. That's a really great thing. It's very much in line with the advice authors are given about the newsletter. And I just composed my monthly newsletter. And again, it's not been monthly because I try. I don't really have anything to tell them. I did this one more in my voice than ever before, not trying to be formal, just trying to be me, trying to be silly, a little offbeat, and share a couple interesting things that are going on. And I honestly think that'll have a much better impact, because I've always felt like I've known you even before I met you, just having your voice in my head. But then hearing you share, you know, the walk you went on, and you compared it to writing. I mean, you drew, it's like a sermon. I don't need to go to any sort of mass, because my mass is the creative pen.
Oh, goodness, that's a little much.
No, but I mean, in some ways, and I know I'm not exaggerating that much, when it can be for a writer, hearing from another writer and hearing that they're, even though they're on a different journey, they're on a different path, hearing that relationship to things in your life that go back to being a creative person, to being a creative, as you so adeptly call your listeners, that creates, I'm not surprised at all that Patreon's been so successful for you. That's exactly what, you know, Mark Dawson and Nick Stevenson and all of those who've been sharing how to connect with your community, how to connect with your readers. That's exactly what they're getting at. And you've done that through example over the years. So again, I can't help but praise you. I have this great opportunity to praise you on stage. I'm going to take advantage of it.
Oh, you're sweet. So you mentioned there your newsletter, which was good, and the voice aspect, which I think is really important. But has anything else changed for you as an author? Like when I met you recently, you talked about a slight pivot that you've been doing with your Haunted series. Yeah.
So, I mean, the Haunted books have always been a passion, right? The first book I wrote was Hamilton, the city I live in, ghosts and historic ghosts, then Sudbury and Ottawa, and then Haunted Bookstores and Libraries and Tomes of Terror, because I'm a big book nerd. But then the accumulation, the one that's my magnum opus, is the Spirits Untapped, Haunted Bars and Breweries. I mean, craft beer and the love of my life. That's what we do, is we craft beer together. That's it's how we met. It's how we've grown together. We spent shortly after I saw you in Oregon, she flew out to Portland. We met and we spent 4 days just enjoying the entire artsy scene, especially the crafty artsy scene. So Spirits Untapped is one of those. And it's one of the ones that I will probably be sad when, because we've got the blog at spiritsuntapped.com, but I'll be sad when that book project is over, because I know that even once the book is done, I'm going to still want to write about the beer things and the beer touristy things that we tend to do together. So that has changed. I've made a lot of mistakes in the last few years, and I'm curious to know what are the things that you consider, and what are the mistakes that you've made, and what are some of the lessons that you've learned over the past couple of years?
Well, there's been, and mistakes is a difficult word, isn't it? Because, of course, we try things. Sometimes they don't work out that well. So one of the biggest things I did was repackaging and rebranding the first three novels in the Arcane series. So you remember way back when they were Pentecost, Prophecy and Exodus, which to many people sound like religious books. But even I have a master's in theology. I'm not a Christian and these are not Christian books. And so they're actually more like Dan Brown, you know. So I redid the covers and renamed them Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone, Ark of Blood. So they're conspiracy thriller with a sort of, you know, religious angle. And rebranding and repackaging those was really hard work because you actually have to do so much. You can actually retain the reviews, but it becomes an absolute nightmare. And also, of course, I'd made a bit of a misstep in terms of how readers perceived me. And I've met quite a few people now who said, oh, I thought you were a Christian writer. I thought that's the niche you were in. And I was like, well, no, but that's the impression I gave. So that was it wasn't a mistake. It was a misstep because I got the branding wrong. And actually it was my current agent who suggested the rebranding and the repackaging, and for which I'm really grateful. Sometimes it takes somebody on the outside to take you out of your head. And I think this is actually a big issue with indies. So often we think one thing because we know our books, but actually having someone on the outside can really help. So that was one big thing that I want people listening to take away, because I think it's applicable to so many people.
Could I ask about that a little bit more? So that was a hard thing for you to do. There's a lot of processing. There were a lot of things you knew you were going to lose. Did that actually hurt you and hurt your sales? Because I think it's important for people to understand, because I've actually been talking to authors recently and I use that and I sent them to your blog post as an example of that. Here's what Joanna did. Did that ended up hurting you in the short term?
No.
And did it help you in the long run?
It probably hurt me briefly, but who knows how, it definitely hasn't in the longer run. It was just a lot of pain in terms of, you know, actually redoing everything, especially print books, you know, getting all the new files done. And, you have to kind of, you can upload new Kindle files, but of course, there's lots of people who still have the old Kindle files and Amazon are very reticent to kind of push out an updated file. And so I think basically it was a misstep, rather than a mistake. But for example, I started out publishing my fiction under Joanna Penn, and it was 2 years later, it was 2014. No, it was before that, like 2013, I think, when I changed my fiction to JF Penn. So, and you mentioned voice, and I think this is so important. I didn't grow into my voice as a fiction author until like I wrote Desecration, like book five.
Really?
I still feel reticent to share JF Penn because it, you know, it's a darker side, as you struggle, I think, to share some of Mark Leslie, because we have a corporate side and a outwardly facing helpful side, but yet both of us have a dark side. I've read some of your horror, and you know, and when people read your fiction, it's like they see inside your head in a very different way. So, you know, we understand. I mean, maybe that's why we're friends outside of business, is that we actually have read each other's work, a fiction work, and we kind of like, oh yeah, I know that person a bit more because of seeing inside their head. So I want to encourage people around making these type of mistakes, because literally I don't think I knew. I didn't know what I was writing. I didn't know what my branding should be. I kind of still don't, but I'm very, very glad I created another brand as JF Penn. Really, really glad. That was a good thing to do. And then I'm really glad I did repackage those books. And I think I understand who I am a lot more, but it definitely takes time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I think you did some things very, very correct and perfect in the original branding for Pentecost and Prophecy and Exodus, because you were targeting the Dan Brown audience. You were targeting the people who were looking for those religious tie-in thrillers based on your understanding of theology and background, et cetera. But then as the market shifted, you recognized there was a different audience and there were some misunderstandings based on, I mean, I think it was, you think it, I see it as, I mean, but it's all part of a learning experience. Is that, okay, exactly. I tried this. Now I learned from that. Now I'm going to do this. And wow, it's even, I mean, I love the fact that you kept Arcane, right?
I love Arcane. Very consistent.
Yeah. I mean, but that was still part of that. And you got even darker in your fiction. I do want to explore that a little bit, because the London Psychic series, again, you know, I love Dr. Morgan Sierra. I love her character. She's kick-ass. There's disturbing things that happen even as the novels open. But then the London Psychic takes you even darker down the darker alleys. And wow. Have you found there must be a lot of good crossover in your readership who read the Arcane series but then also read the London Psychic series?
I find them quite a different group. Like, some people will email me and say, I really don't like the Arcane books, but I love the Psychic books, or vice versa. It is really interesting. And this is why, another kind of lesson for everyone, the biggest thing, if people email me and say my books aren't selling, is, do you have a series? Because, you know, the people who found me since the London Psychic books, like Desecration, they didn't even want to read the Arcane books anyway, and vice versa. So if I didn't have the two series, then I wouldn't be attractive to those two different audiences. And I've just started work on a third series that I don't know where it's going to go yet. But what's interesting, I'd say, is that, you know, Kobo commissioned me for those short stories based on Dante's Inferno, when Dan Brown's Inferno came out. And those stories still draw me. So, and I still get comments about those stories actually being the darkest thing that I've written, which is really, really funny. So it's interesting how these things come back. But I do want to, just on mistakes, there is something else I want to talk about. And that's something I haven't talk too much about yet, so I wanted to bring it up here, which is translations. So a couple of years ago, I was all in for, like, yeah, indies, go translation. We can do this. And we saw sites like Babel Cube, which I never used Babel Cube. So what I did was basically put a shout out on the podcast and went with people I met and say, hey, I'd love to work with people on, you know, we're doing kind of co-publishing, in that I'm not going to pay for a translator, but we will share 50-50 royalty split, which is much more than a translator would normally get if the book sells. But in return, I want a marketing partner. So my idea was to find people like me who were also translators, and that together we would make more money than if I tried to sell my foreign rights. Now, I haven't been talking about it much because I've been buying my translators out and unpublishing all of those books. So this has cost me quite a bit of money but what's kind of crazy, right? I also licensed a 3-year deal to a German publisher. So I've done both. I've sold licensed rights and I've done co-publishing with translators, and none of it has made any money. And my last royalty statement from the German publisher was €3 for 6 months. I know, which is crazy. And so what I've ended up doing, because the money that it's made has been worth less than my time in actually processing all the sales at the end of every quarter. So I've been like, okay, well, look, I've been paying my translators out to get the rights back, because I had signed with them for like a 10-year deal. So basically my plan now, and I think the mistake was in overestimating sales in other languages right now, because as you said, the ebook market is not very mature in many other places. Like somewhere like France, for example, I mean, they're just so anti-digital, it's crazy. And my second issue was overestimating the ability of someone who is a translator to also be a marketer. And that was a mistake on my part, and also the translator's part. All of them said, I wanted to do the marketing, but there's no time, there's, you know, all of this type of thing. So basically, I wanted to talk about it as a mistake, because it's cost me quite a bit of money. And I think you'll notice too, how many authors, I think like last year, a lot of people were like, yay, translations, and it's died down quite a lot. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people have not made money with this. And then I was trying to consider why this was an issue. And then I realized that the reason why is I had one book in each language. And as we know, one book is completely pointless. So what I would have been better doing was doubling down in one language and doing the whole series. So that was what my aim will be next, will be to say, okay, so I've got 9 books in the Arcane cycle. I'm going to call it a cycle, which is Morgan's books. What can I do with those 9 books in a country rather than taking each book individually? And as we know, one book is really, really hard to sell. So you're in Canada, which obviously has French, and you know, Kobo has things in different languages. What are your feelings on translation and indies?
So, I mean, we did the experiment with translations and the money to earn back. So we did the co-publishing with some authors. So we took Bella Andre and Barbara Freethy and Tina Folsom and started to do collaborative translations into French. And so the interesting one was with Lucy Kevin. So Bella's pseudonym, Lucy Kevin, had never had any books in French. So we were starting completely from scratch, just like an author would be doing. And the 5 books in the series, it wasn't until the 5th book was released that we actually started to see the money come back. It wasn't until we did the giant box set and the additional content as per Joanna Penn that actually started. Now, the other thing we did too is we were way too generous with the authors. No, I mean, which is a good thing. It's a great default position to have. And we need to be generous to the authors. But from a business perspective, when I look at it, I said, oh, geez, if we had done this a little bit differently, where in the early days to make our money back, we keep a little bit more. And then once the advance is earned out, then we give them the full Monty. Then we give them everything. So then we could have done more because we would have earned our money back sooner. So then we could reinvest that money. And so that's kind of and again, as you know, as you say, more is better. I mean, I've used Babelcube. I had the first book I'd ever published in 2004. It's now in Italian through Babelcube. I think I've made $10 in total.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, but I look at it and say, well, there's now people reading my stuff in Italian, and they never were. My investment was a bit of time and energy working collaboratively with a translator. And I still think that in other markets, now we're seeing growth in France for sure. That's our biggest growing market. So year over year, 2 years ago to last year, was a 45% increase from Kobo Writing Life in France. And this year we're trending to a 30% increase. So again, as the dollars become bigger, the percentage goes down a little bit, but it's still double digit growth. Because overall,
but
we're growing.
Growth from like $1 plus 45% is still $1.45.
Well, no. I actually have to. I have to call out some of the stuff that we've been doing. Now, keeping in mind, in a market like France, Fnac, our retail partner, plays a much more significant role. You know, Kobo in Canada, yeah, we have Chapters Indigo, but Kobo in Canada is a power on its own in other territories, and that's why we recently announced the Fnac Spain. The retail partner really represents the lion's share of our sales. And so the stuff that we're doing with Fnac has been phenomenal. Julie de Lestrange was an author who came out of KDP Select probably 4 or 5 months ago as a native French author, not translated. And her sales have actually shot past people who've been on Kobo all year. In a 4-month period, she's actually in the top 25 overall from Kobo Writing Life, and that's mostly sales in France.
But I would think the big thing here is also, you said she's a native French speaker. I can't email with readers in French or German or anything else. I can't have a newsletter in these languages. I can't do social media in these languages. And this was a big issue. So all I'm saying is my plan now, and let's, you know, start to look forward, is that in the next 2 years, so by November 2018, I want to have licensed my foreign rights, unless there is a partner. There is a partner who can do marketing. So the only success I've had with this translation is with the lovely Cyril, and I'm not going to say his name in case everyone pitches him, but Cyril has a platform for authors in France, and he's translated and published some of my books for authors in French. And because he's got the newsletter, he speaks French, he's in France, he's doing all the marketing, we're actually making some money. So I think just the point here for anyone who's interested interested in translation is, yeah, if you're Tina Folsom and you're German English and you can do German English, or you're, you know, that lady and you speak French, then yes, do it. But if you don't, I think it's really, really hard. So, So let's switch to looking forwards, because we're totally running out of time.
We're having too much fun. That's it.
We are having too much fun. So you mentioned, and I think this is probably the biggest deal. You mentioned AI, big data, and curation. Now, I think this is the big thing that's going to happen, because obviously Amazon are doing it, you're doing it, Kobo's doing it. I don't think Nook is, but iBooks, I'm sure, are doing it. How do you think we're going to see discoverability and like automatic curation work with the rise of AI?
Oh, it's I mentioned it earlier when we talked about what we're doing with big data, and it's a significant shift. You have to remember, I come from traditional bookselling background, where, you know, before you walk into a store, those books have gone through, you know, 8 levels of curation, right? Like before you even got there. And imagine, you know, you have this on Amazon, you have it on Kobo, not having a single storefront. You know, right now, the way that we merchandise our stores are, we have merchandiser for the UK, merchandiser for Australia, merchandiser for Canada, merchandiser for France, merchandiser for Germany. There will always be some level of curation in that way. But when you go to the storefront right now in the UK, and now you can on Kobo, there's a little map at the top. You can actually click the little flag, and now I can see what you see in the UK, which is awesome. I still can't buy. I still have to go back to Canada to buy, but at least I can see what my book looks like in the UK. So I can see the pounds and everything. I can see the ranking. But when I go to that site in the UK, perhaps I should be seeing a different store experience. Now, the store experience is going to be based on what's selling well in that market, but also what the connections are in that market for readers in that market, which I can't overstate how important that level of machine-assisted curation could be. I like that term, machine-assisted curation, because it's not just an algorithm that says everyone who bought this bought that. It's an algorithm that goes deeper and talks about, you know, percentages read, and it really gets into, why did you like it? Did you actually read it? Did you actually rate it high? You know, how does this connect to you personally, and how do you get more of that experience? Mobile, and you talk about this a lot. We have not even properly exploited mobile. But when I check in on Swarm, I'm getting recommendations via Foursquare and all the, based on places where I've been, based on recommended items off the menu. There's more and more of that location-based thing. Imagine that I'm walking through a location where a nun got burned alive in one of your novels, and I get, because they know I'm a reader, they show me your book and say, hey, you're enjoying hanging out in this beautiful, you know, setting. Why don't you check out these books? I mean, there's so much more we can do taking AI and machine-assisted curation plus human curation plus GPS location-based. I think we've only just begun to explore that. I still want to see an interactive murder mystery where you have to go to physical places to get the clues. Mm. But you don't get the clues
like
until
Pokemon
you get
Go, them. Basically.
Like Pokemon Go, but imagine a murder mystery. Imagine that I have to go where Morgan Sierra goes in order for her to see the next clue. And if I go to the wrong place, this book could take me years to experience, like Pokemon Go. It could be a long-term commitment where Morgan Sierra's has a Toronto-based adventure that you've put together, and I have to go to the CN Tower, or I have to go to Niagara Falls in order to follow her along and either help her solve. I don't know. I mean, there's just so much that could be done in the future, I guess.
No, I think that fits more into the augmented reality / virtual reality space, that kind of gaming. But coming back to, which I am also excited about, but I think that is more than 2 years away. But what I do think is coming, you mentioned mobile and also the internet boom. So by 2020, the stated goal of companies like Facebook, Virgin, Qualcomm, a whole load of other companies, SpaceX, you know, is for 4G or 5G internet to the whole world. So what we're looking at is in the net by 2020. So by November 18, 2018, we're probably looking at 2 billion, 3 billion more people coming online. And because of the $5 smartphone that launched in India, it could be that the devices are free. So I think that's probably what's going to happen is, wow. You know, what we're also going to see is that is control of the internet, which is slightly more dodgy. But I'm someone like Kevin, I've been listening to Kevin Kelly a lot. And Kevin, he's got this book called The Inevitable, which I think everyone should read. And he talks about humanity being 50.1% or something like that, but as in over 50% of humanity is for the good. Now, there might be 49.9% for the bad, but I believe in the good of humanity, that to bring on between 2 billion and 5 billion more people onto streaming internet on cell phones. It won't be on a laptop like you and I are recording, you know, on our bigger devices. It will be on a cell phone. So for me, the big thing in the next 2 years will be mobile sales to countries outside of the current fast internet. And that, right. I fully expect that to be a transformation. Like that's what I'm so excited about. And that's why pairing that with AI is exciting, because you know, I have readers in Rwanda. Like whenever this guy from Rwanda emails me, I email him back going, I'm so excited, you know, and I love that. And actually, Dan, the guy who's now doing the podcast, hello, Dan. He's in the Marianas Islands, which if you remember, I sold a Kobo book to, and I was like, I never heard of that place. And so this is the thing. I think what we're looking at in the next 2 years, this is my big pick for the next 2 years, is mobile sales and sales outside of US, Canada, UK, Australia are going to be the biggest expanded market. And indies are going to be very well placed, because most traditional publishers just are not even interested in these markets, and they are not publishing their authors in those markets. Whereas through Kobo, iBooks, Amazon, and these other platforms, through something like Drafter Digital, Streetlib, other platforms, we can actually reach those cell phones. So that's probably my most exciting pick.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I'm on board with that. I completely agree. I mean, that's why Kobo has done the expansion that we've done. We recognize that these markets are still in the early, early phases, early stages. The growth that we're seeing there is slower to come. But again, it's a much better, is a much bigger market than anyone really realizes when you only think about English language and Western.
Yeah. Right. And I'm still thinking English language, because we're so lucky, you know, the British Empire was an awful thing in many ways, but what it did do is make English kind of pervasive. other things that I'm picking for the next 2 years is a collaboration engine. This is what I'm calling it. So I might have to just buy the URL, because, so, you know, I did this co-writing thing with Jay Thorne. I've done these things with translators, which didn't work. Next year, I'm doing more co-writing. What we don't have is the equivalent of ACX for publishing. So unless you are the publisher and you get all the money to your account and then you do all the publishing, co-publishing is extremely hard right now. Right. So one of you, with Jay, I published the book, and every couple of months I pay him some money. But what would be nice is an ACX model for, and ACX have done a very good job of it, but they are obviously just for audio, and also they are locking everyone into a particular system. So what we need is an agnostic collaboration engine where, like, you and I can decide to write, I'm like, okay, let's do a book on spirits on Untapped in the UK, but we co-publish it together, and then the engine will automatically pay us both the royalties.
Divide them up.
Yes. So I'm picking that, and I keep talking about this because I don't want to build it, and I've talked to a few people about this. I think there's big money in that.
Yeah.
in that software.
I'm gonna sound a little archaic when I say this, but isn't that what a publisher does?
Yes.
Absolutely. An archaic agnostic collaboration engine.
No,
we just need a digital one.
You're exactly right, but I don't want, for example, I want to do more co-writing. Say I want to co-write with you, I want to co-write with Jay, I want to co-write with my friend Orna. But I don't want to keep being the publisher. It's a right pain in the neck.
That's a huge limiting factor for indie authors, because one person has to step up and say, all right, I'll take responsibility for filling out the forms and creating the account. Yeah. Then I have to now send you guys reports and then you have to trust me.
To do this. And box sets. Box sets are a good example. Because at the moment, one person has to publish the box set and the other and then pay out to everybody else with a multi-author box set. So that's another pick of mine. We're getting the tools slowly. The tools are maturing as more and more authors need this stuff. And I think the reason co-writing has not taken off massively, I mean, multi-author box sets have, but I think more people want to co-write, but because it's really painful, they're not. But I see collaboration as being a huge part. And for example, what if I want to do that mobile thing? What do I have to license my rights to a mobile person, or can we collaborate with this engine? Or what if I want to do a 3D printing pattern? Can I offer a percentage of my royalties to a 3D designer, 3D printing designer? Like, I see this type of collaboration between creative people as something that could really liberate and bring in so much more creativity into this space.
Yeah, exactly. And again, leveraging the right creative people in the right ways to properly exploit, and I use exploit in a positive term, but properly exploit what they're best at, to make something that you could never have made in the history of creation before, which is, that's fantastic. I'm going to get started on that.
Well, every time I talk about it, I think, gosh, I should really build that myself, because I think there's money there. Like, you know, like a Kickstarter, take a tiny percentage of the projects that go through them, and they're, you know, making an Airbnb, all these models that are kind of collaboration marketplace type models, taking a little percent, you know, it is a big, I think this is a big, big deal. So anyway, those are some of my picks, and you know, there's so much more we could talk about, but we are definitely out of time. So I wanted to just kind of take it down a notch and kind of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks with the US, and this whole year we've seen political changes in the US, the UK. We're about to see it in France, I believe. Canada got a really nice prime minister, so you can all like just stay in your own nice island. But I know people are a lot of people will be worried with what we've talked about. A lot of people will feel like, oh my goodness, how am I going to deal with AI? What if AI takes all the jobs? What if the political climate changes and goes anti-creative, anti-whatever? How do you recommend that people cope with this change? And how should people stay productive?
That's a great question.
In the next few years?
Well, I have to say, Canada is a Commonwealth country, so things that happen in our mother country, but we still think of England as our mother country, does have an impact on us. That was a difficult thing that happened. The U.S., we're connected to them as our closest neighbor. We're building our own snow wall right now. I mean, there's a lot of angst and anxiety and divisiveness that I've never seen before. And I mean, I've only been around 47 years, but that terrifies me. The beautiful thing that we have as writers, the beautiful thing that we have as creators, is that we have the ability to tell stories. And the stories aren't just escapist stories. The stories are a reflection held up to reality. They're a reflection of who we are as people, who we are as a culture, who we are as a global society. It points out the things that we can say in fiction that we can't say on a Facebook feed because we lose 1,000 friends when we do that. It points out observations that if I point out to you my difference in political opinion and your difference in political opinion, we're just going to get angry with each other and fight and not talk to each other. But if I can roll out a narrative in which we can both see how much we actually have in common as well as the differences without it being a personal clash, there's magic and there's power in that. And I think as writers, as creators, we've never had a more important role than ever before to be able to tell those stories and to talk about the things that are critical to talk about, to talk about what's important, what binds us together as humans, to talk about adversity and speaking up and not being silent and not letting something happen just because, well, it doesn't really affect me. I think in many ways we're boiling frogs. We've been in the water and we're watching the water boil around us and we're not even realizing what we're doing to ourselves. As storytellers, as creators, we owe it to ourselves to help us get out of the water. We owe it to ourselves to actually tell those stories in nonfiction and fiction ways as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So I think writing has never been more important because we can help one another, whether we need to escape or whether we need to really just hold up that mirror to reality and point out some things that should be obvious to us boiling frogs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will echo that and say, you know, if you're feeling confused or stressed or whatever, unplug your internet. Do not get on yes. Facebook or Twitter or any of these things and just go write, you know, go analog, take your notebooks, take your pen, go somewhere where you do not have to see everything else that's going on and just write. You know, the other day I was just like, my to-do list is so big and I just got out the notebook and started planning the next series. And I was so happy. I was just like, oh, I'm just loving this. I'm just going to ignore the other stuff. And I'm just going to create stuff. And the other thing I want to commit to for the next 2 years, I'm going to commit to episode 400. So
yes, that's awesome.
So committing to everyone. What I'm also committing to is to be a positive voice. I hope everyone feels that I am, but I want to commit to trying to keep people upbeat about the changes that we're going to go through. I've recently added this little futurist thing. In the last couple of shows, I've been like, the news might be terribly bad, but here are some great things going on in the world. So I'm going to commit to trying to bring everybody forwards in terms of the technology and the acceptance of what's happening. And that's what I'm going to commit to.
Fantastic.
You want to commit to anything, Mark?
Yeah, you know what? I want to commit to being with you to get to that episode 400.
Oh,
for sure.
Fantastic.
Both
great.
As a fan and a listener, but also a Kobo Writing Life to be there to support you and sponsor you, because we need that positive voice. We need that creative energy and we need more writers. We basically need writers to keep doing what they're doing. I do have to say the unplug part, an essay to read, Henry David Thoreau on walking, was written over 100 years ago, applies so beautifully today to unplugging and to go out on a walk and to actually just absorb the world around you, the natural world around you, whether you live in a city, whether you live in the country, it does not matter. It's one of the best things you can do as a creative person and just to keep your sanity in all of this madness that we're going through. So I reread that essay every couple of years and I keep going, did he just write this last week? Because this is just so brilliant.
That's awesome. So we will be back. I'm sure I'll have you back on the show before November 2018, Mark. Until then, or until the next time, where can people find you and Kobo Writing Life and everything online?
Well, I'm at Mark Leslie on Twitter or marklesley.ca, not .com, because I'm Canadian. And Kobo Writing Life. So check out kobowritinglife.com. That is where we have our own podcast, our own blog information for writers, including a recent article on going for a walk and how that can help your writing, thanks to folks like Kevin J. Anderson, who you had recently on the show. Those are the places. And at Kobo Writing Life on Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Mark. That was brilliant.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.